This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao, in for Frank Stacio. Many people credit the feminist movement with the change in gender dynamics in the United States in the last few decades. Women now earn college degrees at higher rates than men. We've also seen women make large political and socioeconomic strides. But scholar Deandra Rose argues that these changes are not just a result of the feminist movement. Federal public policy has also played a part. She lays it all out in her new book. It's called Citizens by Degree: Higher Education Policy and the Changing Gender Dynamics of American Citizenship. Deandra Rose is a professor of public policy and political science at Duke University. Welcome back to the show, Deandra.
Thank you so much, Anita. It's wonderful to be here.
So at the crux of your book is a conversation about citizenship. And your definition is citizenship beyond just legal status. Tell me about your definition and how citizenship plays a part.
That's right. So moving beyond this very basic conceptualization of citizenship, I really think about it broadly in terms of equality and full inclusion in civic and social life, in political life, and in economic life. And so in addition to that item, I also think about it in terms of one's status or standing in the polity. So the extent to which someone could be classified as a first-class or a second-class citizen.
So what does it mean to be a first-class citizen?
So for me, it's somebody who's treated equally, who enjoys the responsibilities as well as the privileges of citizenship, someone who has the capacity to engage in political life, who might run for office or at the very least have the capacity to exercise the franchise by voting, someone who is who has access to occupational opportunity, to educational opportunity, and really does get to experience everything that the United States has to offer.
So you say to understand how women have become first-class citizens, we need to think more broadly about the welfare state. We think of welfare as being, you know, food stamps, SNAP, Medicaid, but you say it's actually something bigger.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right. I think of the welfare state, and when I think of the term welfare, it's important to note that it's a really loaded concept. So oftentimes we think of it in terms of TANF, temporary assistance to needy families, or even perhaps the food stamp program. And those of absolutely are included in this conceptualization. But I think we also ought to recognize that housing policies and healthcare policies and higher education policies also contribute to the capacity of citizens to have equal opportunity and to have socioeconomic mobility.
So as we said in the introduction, many people think the reason why so many more women are in college today has a lot to do with women marrying later, big changes in the feminist movement in terms of expectations of women and what they can do. You say, yes, that's a part, but we
Absolutely.
Also need to look at three important higher education policies. Tell me about the first one, the
Sure.
National Defense Education Act.
Okay, so the National Defense Education Act was passed in 1958. It provided the very first broadly reaching need-based federal student loans. In 1965, government actors followed up on this policy and created the very first federal need-based student grants. And so, you know, it's interesting to think about the fact that these policies emerged during the mid-20th century, because before the 1950s, before the late 1950s, lawmakers had attempted to get some federal financial aid program going, and it had been unsuccessful, like every single time. And oftentimes this was because historically Americans haven't been very comfortable with the federal government moving into the area of higher education. We really thought that this was something that was best reserved to the states and localities. And so it's interesting to think about the lawmakers who were successful in doing this. And I think this story is one of the things I'm most proud about this book.
So we think about the GI Bill is really paving the way for men's access to college, because it was primarily men that came back and were able to take advantage of that. You say that NDAA really created an opportunity for women. Mm-hmm. How was it that women were able to capitalize on NDEA?
Mm-hmm. That's such a great question. So it's important to note that before the mid-20th century, there was a really interesting gendered calculus of investment in higher education in families. So if a family had, let's say, limited resources and the task of educating sons and daughters, oftentimes they would elect rationally to educate their sons. sons, with this idea that sons were going to become breadwinners for their families. And so it was often the case that women were really forced to find some alternate source of support. And they couldn't turn to public support because government policies really didn't include women at that point. And so they really needed to rely on private sources of support. So the GI Bill did a lot, you know, in terms of helping to change the game when it came to federal intervention in higher education. And it really got the federal government in the business of working with students and helping to expand educational opportunity. But because of the draft and the fact that such a huge proportion of the beneficiaries of the GI Bill were men, women were largely left out. And so by creating a federal higher ed policy that was granted on the basis of financial need and not military service, the federal government really brought women into this new relationship of support.
And it had a lot to do with the Cold War. Tell me how Sputnik is a part of the story.
So Sputnik was a game changer. So to set the stage, there were two Southern Democrats from Alabama, Lister Hill and Carl Elliott. Lister Hill was in the Senate. Carl Elliott was in the House of Representatives. And they had tried in the late 1940s and early 1950s to create a federal financial aid policy unsuccessfully. And they usually died on the issues of race and religion. You know, there was a lot of debate about whether the federal government should provide support for, say, parochial schools, or if even by providing federal financial aid to states, especially southern states that were in the process of grappling with the Supreme Court's decision in Brown versus the Board of Education, whether to desegregate, whether tying federal financial funds to the support for students would actually give the federal government the capacity to tell southern states what to do. So that always held up these policies. So they had these existing proposals that had failed. And then in October of 1957, Sputnik happened. So the Soviet Union launched this satellite into space and literally rocked our world. So the U.S. was convinced that we were the most, you know, scientifically and technologically advanced nation in the world. And, you know, yet there's a Soviet satellite that's orbiting, you know, the atmosphere. And people were freaking out and they're thinking, oh, my gosh, are they, you know, checking out our military capabilities? Like, somehow are we compromised? And to make matters worse, about a month later, the Soviet Union launched a second satellite. And this time it had a dog on it. So, you know, they were just showing off at this point. And so, you know, people in the United States really started to look for a culprit and to figure out what was the problem. And very quickly, we decided that it was education, that somehow we were not investing in the education of our citizens. And they oftentimes describe this as manpower or, you know, more gender neutrally, brain power. And so lawmakers recognized that this was a window of opportunity that they could take advantage of to essentially repackage their existing policies, to, you know, take an existing federal scholarship proposal and to give it a new package. And they tied it with a bow that was this fancy new name, the National Defense Education Act. And even to this day, many people, when they're talking about the NDEA, they really think of it as science or technology support for students who are studying in those areas. But that's only partially true. So the NDEA really did provide support for those areas, but you could receive those benefits if you were studying political science or philosophy or theater, as well as science or engineering or math.
So the NDEA and the HEA, we say both of them, or you argue both of them, are accidentally egalitarian.
That's right.
What does that term mean?
So accidental egalitarianism is this idea that by working to very carefully circumvent political delicacies or very contentious political issues, that lawmakers might accidentally create an opportunity or some really unprecedented support for marginalized groups. And that's exactly what happened in this case. So it was working to very carefully, you know, to tread lightly around the issues of race and religion, to not rock the boat, to convince Southern Democrats to vote for the National Defense Education Act, that lawmakers created a really broad policy. So instead of, you know, normally, I think if they were working in an incremental fashion, we might have seen a policy emerge that looked a lot like the GI Bill. And instead, lawmakers created something that was very general. And it was like, you know, anybody can take advantage of these federal funds, but you just had to get admitted into a school. And so by crafting it in that way, the proponents could convince Southern Democrats that, look, you know, this policy is, you know, broad reaching, but it's not going to disrupt the state of things in southern states by saying that, you know, say this particular group of students can now go to the University of Alabama, for example. And so it was really, I think, quite crafty and quite unintentional to include women, for example, as equal participants. And I think it's important to note that it was, what I argue, as part of a 1-2 punch in terms of expanding educational access. So first, lawmakers provided federal financial funds that helped to deal with the issue of financial need. Financial need was no longer the barrier that it once was to going to college. But we still had institutional discrimination. And so it wasn't until that financial aid was paired with regulatory policy. So the Civil Rights Act of 1964 that led to some racial desegregation of higher educational institutions, and then Title IX in 1972 that led to women's equal inclusion in higher ed institutions that really helped to drive it home.
So let's move to Title IX. When you call NDEA and HEA two redistribution policies, we can think of them in the traditional public policy model of carrots and sticks, right? Those
yes.
two are carrots. Then Title IX is more of a stick.
Mm-hmm.
What did Title IX do, and why is this shift from the carrot to stick model important?
Mm-hmm. So Title IX is really fascinating because most people associate it with athletics. And if you look at the statute, it's interesting to note that it says nothing about sports. This was essentially a reform that basically overhauled how higher educational institutions treated women as applicants. And that was the main purpose of the policy. Before it was even drafted, there was a woman named Edith Green, who was a member of Congress from Oregon, a fascinating figure. And she held congressional hearings on sex discrimination, broadly speaking. And it was very they learned very quickly that higher education was a really central area in the United States where sex discrimination was rampant. So by crafting a regulatory policy that prohibited sex discrimination in college admissions and sex discrimination in college programming, representatives basically reshaped how higher educational institutions treat women as citizens.
So when we look at these three policies together, they have paved the way for women's educational access. Have they done this for all women? Mm-hmm. Do women of different socioeconomic backgrounds and different ethnicities and races all fare the same as mm-hmm. a result of these three policies?
You know, I think that's a really important question. I think that it's fair to say that these policies have contributed to amazing progress for all women. I think, you know, given the fact that they are need-based in terms of the student loans and then sex-based, you know, the requirement that there be sex-based equality in admissions was definitely inclusive. And to women as well as men, I think that it's important to note that as we, you know, today in 2018 see this interesting reversal of that old gender gap, where now we're seeing that colleges and universities are struggling with the task of making sure that there are men who are represented on college campuses in numbers that are similar to or equal to that of women. We see that Title IX and the federal financial aid policies provide some support, important support for a pretty broad range of recipients and beneficiaries. But I think we definitely have a long way to go. And so, you know, for me, I think the really important lesson to take from the history of these policies is that at various junctures, the federal government recognized the central challenges facing higher educational access at different moments in history. So in the mid-20th century, lawmakers recognized the barrier that financial need played. or posed. And then in 1972, they recognized the barrier of institutional discrimination. I think in 2018, we really have to move beyond thinking about, you know, financial aid narrowly or institutional barriers, which I think we're not doing as much, but we're still using that old school focus on financial aid when we have new barriers. So, you know, for me, in addition to the question of access and who can move into colleges and universities easily and with support, we also have to think very seriously about what higher education is and what the nature of the quality of the education is that the people are getting. So I think that the legacy of the history really provides that as an imperative.
Why has the gender ratio flipped so much? Why are women getting college degrees at greater rates than men?
That's an interesting question. I mean, honestly, I'm doing new research trying to figure that out and to disentangle it, and I think it's an interesting puzzle. One of the things that I've been struck by is when you look at men and when you engage in intersectional analysis and look at disparities between men by various factors. So looking, for example, at socioeconomic disparity or even racial disparity, there's a lot of inequality there. So, for example, men of color, even, you know, in terms of moving into higher education, like being in the pipeline of people who are even thinking about applying for college, there are some really troubling disparities there. So for me, I've oftentimes done a lot of work that focuses on that back end of the educational trajectory, looking at, you know, the experience that college students have, you know, access to higher educational opportunity at that late stage of the game, like once you've graduated from high school or once you're a senior. But I'm learning that a lot of this issue really resides in the K through 12 realm. So really thinking about like middle school kids, when they're approaching high school, are they even thinking about college? Are they even getting the kinds of advice and support that they'll need to apply effectively or to know how to pay for it? You know, I think those are some of the things that are crucial.
So in this conversation, it brings up for me the fact that we seem to be having a conversation as a nation right now about the value of higher education and maybe some questions about, you know, should we be supporting liberal arts education or should we be supporting community colleges? Mm-hmm. What argument would you make for what you would like the higher education system to look like? And maybe building upon that, why higher education is relevant in the first place? You say it really connects to this question of citizenship.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right. I mean, so political scientists, I guess to answer that second question first, political scientists have long recognized that higher education is one of the most significant predictors of political participation. So thinking about this, you know, grand endeavor of democracy and this idea that we are governed by ourselves, you know, by a very an ideally inclusive segment of the population, that we're a polity that relies on the capacity of citizens to engage. If we know that higher education provides a really important foundation for that type of engagement, if we're not promoting access to equal access to higher education, then I think we really aren't doing our best to ensure that, you know, democracy can be achieved. I think that when I think of what I'd like higher education to look like, I really think of broad access and I think of shared quality. You know, I think that that consistency in quality is one of the variables that we haven't quite figured out. I think that we should also focus on protecting people who move into higher education. So I think now we're seeing, and this is a part of the discussion, a number of for-profit institutions that disproportionately target potentially or marginalized groups. And, you know, I think that we have to be careful that certain segments of the population aren't straddled with debilitating debt and then an inability to move into occupations that can lead to mobility. So, you know, this is very complex, but I think it's something that we really have to take seriously if we, you know, intend to continue our democracy.
So much more to talk to you about. I wish I had more time. Deandra Rose is the author of Citizens by Degree, Higher Education Policy and the Changing Gender Dynamics of American Citizenship. She's also a professor of public policy and political science at Duke University. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Anita.
Just ahead, rosé. Baby boomers call it cheap and sugary, but for millennials, it's not just a drink, it's a lifestyle. We'll find out why. Stay with us.